couldn't respond. "You don't like my sense of humour," he said. "You think it treasonous." I wanted to say yes, but was too afraid. "You needn't be so resentful," he said. "When you've lived as much as I, you'll learn to neither trust nor love any mortal. Then the only one who can betray you is yourself." I didn't know what to say. "Do you ever smile, boy?" he demanded. "If you can't laugh and smile, life is worthless. Do you hear me?" he yelled. "It's nothing." I winced. Then, smiling, he cocked his head to one side and ruffled up his beard. With a sweep of his hand, he snatched off his hat, revealing a bald pate. "By the love of St. Arnulf the King," he said, "you could do much worse than being bound to me." That stated, he seemed to pull back within himself and give way to private thoughts. Fearing what sudden thing he might do next, I watched him warily. But after a while, he said only, "Do you wish to ask me anything? Who I am? My name? What I'm doing here?"
"It doesn't matter," I stammered.
"Why?" he said.
"Because you're already my master forever."
"So be it," he said, acting as if I'd offended him. For a while he toyed with his hat, not to any purpose that I could see, but as if lost in thought. At length, however, he reached over and took up his sack and rummaged through it.
From it he took out three balls, each made of stitched leather. To my surprise, he tossed the balls into the air. Instead of falling to the ground, they stayed in the air and rotated at his will, with only the smallest touch and encouragement of his fingers. I looked on, astonished.
"What think you of that?" he said, laughing.
"Are they enchanted, sir?" I whispered.
"Hardly," he said, as he continued to keep the balls in the air, sometimes higher, sometimes lower, until, as abruptly as he'd begun, he gathered them in, and they rested upon his great slab-like hands. "I'm a juggler," he said. When I made no response, he said, "Don't you know the word?"
I shook my head.
"A French word. It means I balance things, or toss balls, boxes, knives, anything I choose, through the air and catch them up again. Now what do I do with my skills? I wander from town to town through the kingdom. Not as a beggar, mind you, but as a man of skills. Skills, boy, which enable me to gather enough farthings and pennies to live and keep this belly full." He patted himself on his large stomach. "Believe me," he said, "there's no place in the kingdom I've not been. Gascony, Brittany, and Scotland too, for that matter. What think you of that?" He rushed at me with so many new and strange ideas I couldn't grasp them all. So all I said was,
"I don't know, sir."
He cocked his head to one side. "Do you have any thoughts about anything?" I hung my head to avoid his eyes. He sighed. "What's your name?" I hesitated, not wanting him to call me what I'd always been called, Astor's son. But I wasn't comfortable with my newly discovered name either. He leaned toward me, glaring. "Boy," he said, "as I am your master, let me offer you advice. I'm a simple man. I go by simple means. You'll do as you're told, or suffer the consequences. Now answer me, or, as there is a loving God in heaven, I'll thrash you. What is your name?"
"I'm called Astor's son."
"Astor's son? That's not a name, it's a description. Were you never," he said, "christened with a name of your own?"
"I was told it was Crispin."
"Crispin? That's too fine and noble a name for such rubbish as you. Have you a surname?"
"I don't know,"
God's blood, you might as well have been a dog, he said.
It was all I could do to suppress screams of rage.
Very well, Crispin. For henceforward, that's what I shall call you. I too am bound for towns and cities. But I went my way to such places, not as a runaway peasant beggar like you, but earning my bread with tossing things into the air the way I showed you. People in towns pay fair coins to see my revels in squares, in merchant houses and inns, as well as guild halls. Do you know how to make music?
Music?
By the devil's own spit, he said. Have you lived your life under a rock? Were you born of sheep? Do you know nothing of drums, horns and pipes? Do you even sing?
No, sir.
God's holy wounds, he said. Music is the tongue of souls. Is there anything you can do?
I can follow an ox, sow seed, weed, gather crops, thresh wheat and barley.
Merciful heaven, he said.
And in this town or city you intended to go, were you going to plough the streets there? Unable to withhold myself, I cried out. I don't know what I was going to do. I wanted to gain my liberty, and with God's help I would have, if not for you.
His eyes opened wide. Then he tilted back his head and roared with laughter, as if I'd told the rarest jest of all. Liberty, he said, and with God's help, too, I'll wager. It's a marvel you don't seek out the blessed Saint Crispin himself to come to your aid. No wonder you want to die. The only difference between a dead fool and a live one is the dead one has a deeper grave.
It was as if all the scorn and insults I had ever endured were pouring forth from him. If there had been an open hole in the earth, I would have crawled into it willingly.
Ah, noble Crispin, he went on, our blessed Lord, in his wisdom, must have sent you to me for instruction. I shall begin by teaching you something. Mark me well. With all the armies of the kingdom at your side, you could not gain your liberty on your own. A boy, alone in the city, a wolf's head. Why, any city you entered would swallow you like the whale took Jonah, and not to spit you out either, but only to belch up your empty soul. That said, he erupted with another great laugh. Now go to. Let's see if you're capable of asking me a question.
Struggling to find something, I said, What is your name, sir?
Orson Hrothgar, he said. But people call me Bear because of my size and strength. Pay heed, young Saint Crispin, he added, glaring at me with eyes that seemed to glint. A bear has two natures, sweet and gentle. If he becomes irritated, he turns into a vicious brute. So I beg you to consider the two sides of my nature. Next question.
Where are you going? I said.
To my death, he said, as must all men.
And before that? I ventured.
His eyes seemed to laugh. Ah, you do have some wit. God's truth, before I reach my end, there's work to be done. Big work. The work of ages.
What is it?
He cocked his head and laughed. On the feast of St. John the Baptist, I must meet a man in Great Wexley. Large things are brewing, young Crispin, he said grandly, and I intend to play my part. Let it be as it may be, but time for that to come. Until then, you and I shall wander. Our task is to stay alive and measure this great kingdom with our feet, our eyes, our ears.
With that, he tossed his sack to me.
His meaning was perfectly clear. Huge as he was, I was to carry his belongings. Inwardly lamenting my fate, I lifted the sack and began my life as servant to the bear.
I began to wonder if he was mad. Chapter 20. The lifeless village was soon behind us. Bear went first, moving over the road with the strides of a giant. And what a strange sight he was, with his black tunic, legs of two colours, split hat bobbing and bells jangling. As for me, with his heavy sack upon my back, I had to struggle to keep up. At first we didn't speak. I was too down in my spirits. That I, in fleeing from one cruel master, should be bound to another was almost too much to endure, and to a man who claimed he hated tyranny. More than once I considered dropping the sack and running away. I had to remind myself that I had sworn a sacred oath to stay. To break it would cast me straight away to hell. There was nothing to do but march along and do as God had willed. Then I recalled that Great Wexley was one of the places Father Quinnell had said I could gain my liberties. Perhaps there would be some advantage in my going there. Silently, I prayed it would be so. For the rest of the day we tramped along. In all that time we saw no one, nor came to another village. Once I asked, "Sir Bear, why are there no people about?" "By St. Roch, it's the pestilence," he said, confirming my fears. "Hardly any villages were spared in this area. But farther along, you'll see people aplenty. And in the cities..." "Is there no one left in them, sir?" I asked, worried that they too might have been abandoned. He laughed. "In London, say 30,000-40,000.
40,000?
I cried, astonished.
"Don't worry. It's far more than any man, except the royal tax collectors, can count. And don't call me sir," he snarled.
"Why?"
"It's servile."
"But you're my master."
His answer was a growl. We had trudged on for I don't know how much longer, when Bear stopped.
"We'll take some rest here."
Chapter 21. He led us to a grove of trees. There he flung himself down and told me to do the same. That done, he called for his sack. He rummaged in it, producing more bread, which he tore, and gave me half. When we'd been silent for a while, I still brooding over my unhappy fate, he said,
"I don't think you care for me."
"I have no choice," I said.
"Would you like one?"
"God's will be done," I said.
He shrugged and said,
"You might not believe it, but I was fated to be a priest in the city of York. That's far to the north."
I looked at him anew. Father Quinnell was the only priest I'd ever known. This huge man couldn't have been more different.
"It seems my father grew weary of me," Bear continued. "Said I caused too much trouble and ate too much. In truth," he added with sudden bitterness, "I suspect he offered me to God to fulfil a pledge he'd made in exchange for some profitable trade. Though, I ask you, what kind of man would exchange a boy for a sack of wool?"
His question made me think upon my father. I tried to imagine what kind of man he might have been if he had lived, and if he would have done such a thing with me.
"A punctilious man, my father," Bear went on. "He paid my fees in full, gave me his hasty blessing, and walked away. I never saw him more. Willy-nilly, I was enrolled in the Benedictine Abbey to be a monk. 12 years of age, younger than you, and already in robes, an acolyte."
"Did you become a monk?" I said.
"I was at the Abbey for 7 years. I learned how to pray, how to be silent. I learned to read Latin, French, even English. There's that. It keeps me from the gallows."
"Why?"
I said, for in spite of myself, I found myself interested in his story. The law, if you can read, you're treated as a priest. Common law does not allow priests to be hanged. But shortly before I took my final vows, he continued, when on some errand for my fat and greasy abbot, I came upon a group of mummers in a square close to the York Minster. Their music, tricks, and most of all their laughter beguiled me. Perhaps it was the devil himself who took a liking to my soul. In any case, I ran off. Like you, he added with a laugh.
But how could you abandon God? I said.
Had he not abandoned me?
It was your father, not God, who left you, I said. I must have surprised him with my words, for he grew silent, and when he spoke again, it was with less bravado.
For 10 years I travelled with those people, he said. They became my dearest friends. We went all about the kingdom. Mind you, we lived only a tad beyond beggary. But my companions taught me better languages, the language of song, of hand, of foot, and most of all, of laughter.
Can you still be hanged, then?
Is that your hope? He laughed. Not as long as I can read. But I did the next best thing. I went off to be a soldier.
And abandoned your new friends? I said.
Not abandoned. Disbanded. Only St. Anthony knows where they went. Some wandered off, others lost their lives to brawls, jails, duels or sickness. Some were lost to marriage. The wandering life, the mummer's life, is fragile at best. He shrugged. In any case, I'd rather be alone.
Then why? I faltered.
Why what? Speak out.
Then why do you need me? I said.
In response, he reached into his sack and pulled out the leather balls again. As before, he tossed them round and round so that they seemed to float about his hands.
Here, he said, holding out the balls to me. Let me see how skilled you are.
Me?
Of course, you.
I can't do such things.
Saint Crispin, he barked. Stand before me.
Reluctantly, I took my place before him.
"Now pay attention," he said.
Beginning with one ball, he demonstrated how to toss it back and forth between his hands. He told me to do the same. I did so, clumsily at first, but under his insistent commands, I began to grasp his method.
"There! Now," Bear said, "watch this."
He took up a second ball and, along with the first, began to throw it back and forth.
"Do that!"
he said. Tossing 2 balls between my hands was quite another matter. I could barely manage it.
"Again!" he shouted. "And again!"
When I failed, he was always severe, insisting I try over and over again. But at last the balls began to fly for me. After sitting back and watching me intently with his shrewd eyes, he said,
"Enough. We need to move on. You'll practice more. You'll add more balls as you go. Music, too. And I vow by the joy of Christ, you'll learn it well."
"But why?" I said.
"You shall see."
We continued along the muddy road. This time, as we went, Bear sang at the top of his voice.
"Loudly sings the cuckoo, grows the seed and blooms the meadow. Comes the spring, the woods do sing. Sing cuckoo, now sing cuckoo. Sing cuckoo, now sing cuckoo."
Then from his sack he took out a music pipe, a recorder, he called it, and began to play the same melody, after which he sang the verse again.
"Sing!" he commanded.
"I don't know how."
"Crispin, if I bid you to sing, you'll sing," he said.
Haltingly, I tried.
"Louder!"
I complied. As we went along, I was convinced more than ever that Bear was mad. Chapter 22. Toward early evening, Bear found a secluded spot some paces off the road. There he ordered me to stand against a tree. I hesitated.
"Do as I say,"
he said. When I did, he pulled a twist of rope from his sack, and to my alarm proceeded to tie my hands behind the tree. "What are you doing?" I cried, seeing this as confirmation of his madness.
"I need to fetch us some food," he said, pulling the knot tight. "You'll only interfere, and I don't want you running off."
"But I swore I wouldn't," I said. "I beg you, don't leave me here."
"Ah," he mocked, "as God in heaven knows, both wheat and trust take a full season to grow."
Without another word, he went off, leaving me alone. More than once I tested the knot, determined that despite my vow I'd run off, but no matter how I tried, I could not get loose. Instead, my arms grew numb. How long he was gone, I don't know. Enough to fill my heart with more misery and make me swear violent oaths at him. I even screamed for help, though I knew help would never come. But when I caught sight of the sack he'd left behind, I told myself he was bound to return, if not for me, for it. Sure enough, he did. What's more, a large fat rabbit dangled from his hands.
"There, Saint Crispin," he said when he came into view, a great grin on his red-bearded face. "Now you can see that, for good or ill, I always keep my word."
He untied me. Faint from standing so long, my arms aching from being tied, I immediately sat down.
"Do you know the penalty for poaching?"
he said, as he worked his dagger skilfully to skin the rabbit. I was so angry I only shook my head.
"To feed us, I've put both our lives in jeopardy," he said. "That's the kind of freedom that exists in this kingdom."
With flint, steel and tinder, he made a fire, which he told me to stoke with bits of wood. Then he took up the rabbit, spitted it, and soon had it roasting.
"Do you like meat?"
he said, seeing me with my mouth agape. "I've only eaten it a few times," I confessed.
"A few times?"
he laughed uproariously.
"Ah, Crispin, the blessed saints were kind when they guided you to me. For my part, I love meat."
When he proclaimed the rabbit cooked, he tore it apart and gave me some. As I shoved the bits into my mouth with my hands, I admitted to myself it was the best food I had ever eaten. My resolve to flee abated, somewhat. Later, when we had our fill, more meat than I had consumed at one time in my entire life, and the embers of the fire had burned low, Bear told me to lie down on the far side as he wished to speak to me. What madness, I wondered, would he reveal to me now? It had grown dark. The only light was our little fire. A breeze had sprung, which caused the flames to dance. Bear's red beard seemed to glitter in the firelight, so that his face, despite the dark, was equal to any sun. His bald head gleamed like a moon. Indeed, he was big enough to fill the entire sky. Then he began to speak of his many adventures, his riotous life, the marvels he had seen, the scrapes he'd escaped, his fortunes, good and bad. Never had I heard such tales. It was a world and life, a way of being utterly unknown to me. What's more, everything he talked about was stitched with laughter. It was as if life itself were a jest. Except every now and then he'd cry out with an awful anger at what he called the injustices of the world. Then he spoke of his soldiering days, fighting alongside the Black Prince in Gascony and Brittany. "Our master has been fighting in France for so long," I said, "I've never seen him."
"What's his name?"
"Lord Furnival."
"Furnival?"
Bear said.
"You'll be pleased to know his first home is in Great Wexley, where we're bound."
I said, "What manner of man is he?" Bear shrugged.
"I saw him too much. A great landowner, and arrogant. What he lacked in fighting skills, he made up for in bragging, drinking, and killing, in that order."
"But he's a noble knight,"
he snorted. "Do you think that makes him less mortal? By God's everlasting bones, Crispin, war is where the Christian is truly tested. Alas, your Lord Furnival was not one to inspire faith. If there was looting and cruelty to be done, he did more than his share, with a falcon's eyes for ransom. As for those prisoners who would yield nothing," Bear waved his hand dismissively, "doomed. Regarding his fondness for women, I shan't say. But you may believe me, as Jesus shall be our judge, your Lord Furnival shall have much to answer for."
"His steward is cruel," I said.
"A suitable pair," Bear said. "And what village is that?"
"Stromford," I said before I could catch myself.
When he lapsed into silence, I thought of what Bear had said about Lord Furnival. It made me uneasy, thinking it might have been a mistake to reveal my connection and where I'd come from. There could be a danger if Bear was truly mad and we were going there. And yet, he seemed to know so much, more than any man I'd met. How, I asked myself, would he consider me when he knew more of what I was? The fire smouldered. A breeze blew, a bird whistled into the dark. My uneasiness had just begun to subside when Bear said,
"Now, Crispin, it's time I learned the truth of you."
Chapter 23. I hardly knew what to say. I felt a desire to speak about who I was and what had happened, yet it didn't seem proper. He was, after all, my master. I was his servant. We were not equal. But before I could think more on it, he said,
"When did your mother die?"
"A short time ago," I said.
"May the blessed Saint Margaret care for her in heaven," he said, crossing himself. "What manner of woman was she?"
Since no one had ever asked me about my mother, it was difficult to know where to begin. Just to think of her brought pain to my heart.
"She was shunned by the others in our village," I said, "nor did she talk very much. When she did, she was bitter."
"Why so?"
"I don't know. Sometimes I thought it was because she was slight and frail. The steward, the bailiff, and the reeve always set her difficult tasks. More often than not, they made her work alone. But though she worked as hard as she could, she received little thanks."
To my surprise, there was a relief in speaking. How strange it was to have someone listen to me. I went on. "Sometimes she would hold me to her. At other times she seemed to find me repulsive. Sometimes I thought I was the cause of her misery."
"And your father?"
"He died before I was born, in the pestilence."
"No other kin?"
"None."
His eyes narrowed.
"How can that be?"
I shrugged. "My mother said they also died in the Great Death."
"A common enough story. I escaped it."
"How?"
"By running as far north as I could go, to Scotland's wild northern isles." "And your mother no surname?"
"I never knew it."
"Do you ever want to know these unknown things? About your name, your mother, your father?"
"I do," I said, "but I don't know how."
He was quiet for a while, as if thinking on what I said. Then he said,
"Now, Crispin,
tell me of how you came to be proclaimed a wolf's head."
Chapter 24. By then I'd slipped so easily into talking, I simply told him what had happened, as much as I could recall. When I'd done, he asked,
"And they proclaimed you a wolf's head for that?"
I nodded.
"To be a wolf's head is to say you're no longer human. So anyone may kill you," he grinned. "Even me."
But he went on seriously.
"Your priest told you to flee?"
"Yes."
"And since your steward tried to kill you, your priest was proved right."
After a moment, I said, "And they killed Father Quinnell." Bear sat bolt upright.
"Kill the priest?" he cried. "In the sacred name of Jesus, why?"
"I don't know, but when he told me I had to leave, he also promised he'd tell me something of importance just before I left. Instead, he was slain."
"Have you any idea what he was to say?"
"Something about my father and mother. So I think his death was my doing. God was punishing me."
"By killing his priest? It's the thing I've noticed," the big man said with laughing scorn, "that the greater a man's or boy's ignorance of the world, the more certain he is that he sits in the centre of that world."
I hung my head.
"Crispin," he said after a moment of silence, "I'll give you some advice. You're full of sadness. Those who bring remorse are shunned. Do you know why?"
I shook my head.
"Because sorrow is the common fate of man. Who then would want more?" "But wit and laughter, Crispin, why, no one ever has enough. When I think on the perfections of our Saviour, I choose to think most upon his most perfect laughter. It must have been the kind that makes us laugh too, for mirth is the coin that brings a welcome. Lose your sorrows, and you'll find your freedom."
I remembered the word, freedom, as one which Father Quinnell used. After a moment, I said, "But you gave me no choice but to stay with you." His eyes flashed with anger, enough so that I regretted I had spoken. But then, as happened so often with him, he laughed.
"Crispin, do you know why my hat is split into two parts?"
"No."
"Like all men with a skill, I wear the livery of my trade. For me, the two-part hat informs the world that there's more than a simple nature residing in my soul. There's bad and good."
"But I'm only bad," I thought to myself, wishing yet again I knew what sin was embedded in me to have brought God's hand so hard upon me.
"Crispin," said Bear, "a wise man, he was a jester by trade, once told me that living by answers is a form of death. It's only questions that keep you living. What think you of that?"
"I don't know," I said.
"Think on it, for we shall soon be passing out of this zone of desolation. From here on, as God is good, many living villages shall appear. They'll be small, but if we labour well, we can survive, you and I. Will you join me? I give you the freedom to choose."
"You're my master," I said. "I have no choice."
"Crispin, decide," he barked.
I shook my head. "It's not for me to do so."
"Should not every man be master of himself?"
he asked.
"You made me call you master."
His face grew redder than it normally was.
"You're a wilful fool!" he bellowed.
Clearly frustrated, he poked the fire.
"You'll go!"
"As you command,"
I said.
He frowned, but only said, "Before we get there, you'll need to learn some things."
"What?"
"Time enough for that tomorrow. Go to sleep."
Without further ado, he lay down. From the pouch around my neck, I took out my cross of lead and upon my knees prepared to pray.
"What are you doing?" I heard him ask. I looked over my shoulder. Praying?
What's that in your hand?
A cross of lead. It was my mother's, I said, holding it out for him to see. It even has writing on it.
Writing or not, it's useless, he said, waving my hand away. No more than a trinket.
What do you mean? I cried, fearing he was slipping back into madness.
All these things, your cross, your prayers. As God is near, and surely he always is, he needs no special words or objects to approach him.
But this cross, I began. He cut me off.
I know what it is. It's made of lead, made in countless numbers during the Great Death. Never blessed, they were given to the dying as false comfort. They're as common as the leaves, and just as sacred. Crispin, as Jesus is my witness, churches, priests, they're all unneeded. The only cross you need is the one in your heart.
Greatly shocked, I didn't know what to say.
But, he added, with a hard edge of anger, if you so much as spoke my words in public, do you know what would happen to you?
No.
You'd be burned alive, so don't repeat them. And if you said I spoke them, I'd denounce you for a liar and a heretic. So put your cross away. I don't wish to see it again. Keep your faith to yourself.
Though unsettled by his words, I turned away and made my prayers, the cross in my hands. I prayed to St. Giles and asked him to remember my father, whom I'd never seen, my mother, whom I missed so deeply, and last of all, myself. I also promised him I'd not believe the things Bear had said.
Though Bear must have heard me, he didn't interfere.
When I was done, I said, Bear, I'm sorry I know so little.
Sometimes it's better not to know.
How can that be?
Ah, Crispin, if I have learned one thing, it's that he who knows a bit of everything knows nothing, but he who knows a little bit well knows much of all.
He said no more and was soon asleep, grunting like a pig. The fire had collapsed into a heap of smouldering coals. The night being cold, I drew closer to it and tried to make sense of the things that Bear had said. He'd confused me. First, he said it was better to live by questions. Then he said it was a mistake to know everything. I struggled to put the two notions together, but could not. What I did know was that he was unlike any man I'd ever known. There was madness in him, to be sure, yet I couldn't deny some kindness, too. But what vexed me most was his saying that every man should be master of himself. If I knew anything, it was that all men belong to someone. Surely God himself put us all in our places. Lords to rule and fight, clergy to pray. All the rest, like me, were on earth to labour, to serve our masters and our God. Otherwise, it was as much to say stars could go their own way instead of being fixed to turn around our world. Bear had to be wrong. Yet I found myself thinking it was not so bad to have fallen in with him. To be sure, he was a rough and ready man. The things he said confused me. Even his calling me by the name Crispin was unsettling. Still, if Bear fed me and protected me, I might at least survive a while. In any case, I had little choice. God had willed it. And yet, thinking on what he said, I asked myself, if I were to live by questions, what questions would they be? About my father? And those things Father Quinnell had said about my mother, if they be true or not. And maybe, I allowed, I'd asked what was to be my fate. Chapter 25. When I woke in the morning,
I'd spent so much time with Bear's strange ideas, I was in a cross mood, not wishing to deal with him. Nonetheless, he informed me that it was time to begin teaching me some skills. He explained how, upon entering a town, he played and danced, heading straight for the village church. "There I pray, hopefully, at a mass." I said, "I thought you didn't believe in such things." "What I think, Crispin, stays in my head. What I do is there for all the world to see. I must show reverence." "I don't understand you," I burst out, surprising even myself. "You tell me I don't need a church, then you talk like a priest. What are you?"
"A man, nothing more or less. And you?"
"Nothing."
"Why do you insist on that?"
"Because I have no name," I said, my rage bursting forth. "No home, no kin, no place in this world. I'm a wolf's head. Any and all may kill me when they choose. Even you say you want me to do things, think things, but when I won't be able to, you'll shun nor betray me like the rest." I had never said so many words in one breath in all my life. When I'd done, I turned away, alarmed that I'd spoken to my master in such a fashion. "Crispin, in the name of all the blessed saints, have you ever desired to be anything different from what you are?"
"We must be content to be as God made us," I said.
"What if God wishes you to better yourself?"
"Then he will do so."
"Crispin," he said, grabbing me by the neck and hauling me along, "come with me."
He dragged me to a little stream where we had fetched our water.
"Have you ever seen what you look like?" he said.
"A little, by our river, but I don't like to."
"Gaze upon yourself," he said.
Puzzled, I did as he bid, staring at my image in the flowing water. My long hair, my dirty, bruised and tear-streaked face, my red-rimmed eyes.
"Now then," he commanded, "wash your face, using sand to scrub it. Go on. Oh, by God, I'll do it for you."
After I did as he told me, he picked up his dagger.
"What are you going to do?"
I cried.
"Cut your hair." "Now look at yourself again," he said when he was done. "What do you see now?"
I considered my reflection anew.
"Are you different?"
he said.
"A little," I said.
"And that was only water and a blade. Think what you might become if you were cleansed of 13 years of dirt, neglect and servitude."
I turned back to my image and gazed. It was different. For a moment I allowed myself to wonder what it would be like to alter the rest of myself as well.
"As I was trying to tell you," Bear said, interrupting my thoughts, "when I reach a village, I apply to the priest, to the local lord or bailiff, the reeve, if necessary,
anyone in authority from whom I can get permission to perform."
"And you wish me to go with you?"
I asked.
"Of course."
"But, Bear," I said, "what if I'm recognised?"
"Crispin, you are altered. Who would recognise you now?"
"Anyone from Stromford."
"By the certainty of St. Paul, they are gone. They'll never bother you again."
"But what if they do?"
"First you say you're nothing. Then you say half the world is looking for you. Make up your mind, if you have one."
"But, Bear," I said, "the steward tried to kill me. Twice. And when I was hiding in the woods, he came along the road. I'm sure he was searching for me."
He looked at me slyly. "For an insignificant creature, you're very vain. Give me one reason for their concern."
"They think I'm a thief."
"Crispin, did you steal?"
"As God is my witness, no."
"Then it's all a sham. You were only being blamed for what someone else did."
"But it's they who matter, not me."
"Then I shall make you matter," he said. "I'll teach you music."
"I won't be able to learn," I said.
"Do the birds sing?"
he asked.
"Yes,
I said.
"Do they have souls?"
"I don't think so," I said, somewhat confused.
"Then surely you can sing no less than they, for you have a soul."
"Sometimes I think I have none." For once Bear was speechless.
"In the name of Saint Remigius, why?"
I've never felt it."
Bear gazed at me in silence.
"Then we," he said gruffly, "shall need to make sure you do."
Chapter 26. He began by instructing me about the pipe's holes, the stops, he called them, and the way to shape my mouth around the blowing end, how to shift my fingers, how to make different sounds. Reluctantly, I took up the recorder and with fingers like soft clay tried to play. What came out were sorry, shallow squeaks.
"You see," I said, "I can't do it."
I offered him back his pipe. Refusing, he railed at the top of his voice, threatening to inflict upon me every kind of grisly torture if I didn't try. At first, his shouted warnings terrified me, but as the day wore on, I realized he was mostly bluster. While I didn't doubt he could have done the ghastly acts he threatened, it was but a rough kindness. The more I realized this, the less tense I became. Gradually, I found my way with tongue, fingers, and breath. Before the day was half done, I managed to pipe out his simple song.
"There, you've done it," he cried out when first I did. "Tell me that you didn't hear it too."
No one was more amazed than me. To think that I, with my breath, could make a song thrilled me deeply. I wanted to play it over and over again. Bear only made me work harder. Then, as I played, he began to strike his drum, so as to keep the proper beats. It was mid-afternoon and I was playing, when something different happened. Before my astonished eyes, this enormous man jumped up and began to dance, holding his large hands up, pumping his knees high, prancing, his great red beard flapping, his two-pointed hat bobbing this way and that, the hat bells jingling. He was like one possessed. Though a giant, he appeared as light as a goose feather in a swelling breeze. I was so taken aback at the sight, I stopped playing.
"Now do you know why I took you on?"
he said with a grin. It took a moment for me to fully grasp his meaning. He wanted me to help him.
"Play, fool!" he yelled. "That's the point of it all!"
Excited, I resumed, continuing to make music while he paused to scoop up his leather balls. For now, as he danced, he also juggled. Then, to all of this, he added singing.
"Lady Fortune is friend and foe. Of poor she makes rich, and the rich poor also. Turns misery to prosperity, and wellness unto woe. So let no man trust this lady, who turns her wheel ever so."
Finally, he stopped. Punting, he thumped me on the back and said,
"There, Crispin, my young and foolish soulless saint, you see what we shall do? While I perform my revels, you shall pipe the tune. I promise it shall bring us pennies of plenty, and we, the bear and his cub, shall prosper greatly."
His words made me grin. At this, Bear thrust his hand aloft.
"Oh, God!" he cried. "Look upon thy miraculous gift! This wretched boy has given the world a smile!"
That night, as we made ready to sleep, Bear informed me that on the following day we would reach a village by the name of Burley.
"It's only 2 leagues from where we are, an easy walk," he said, "and on the main road to Great Wexley."
Bear's news about the morrow made me very nervous.
Since I'd left Stromford, the only person I'd been with was him. But I said nothing. He would, I feared, only mock my worries. Instead, when Bear was asleep, I went upon my knees and with my lead cross in hands, prayed. "Blessed St. Giles," I whispered to the cross, "let me play the music well. Let me be a credit to my master. And I beg thee, let me have a soul that I too may sing and dance like Bear. And St. Giles, do not let him betray me." Chapter 27. Next morning we set off at dawn, and soon were trudging along the dirt road. At that place it meandered among low hills, so that we never had a clear view for very far. Only through the tree breaks did we catch glimpses of open fields. We'd been going a little while when Bear abruptly halted. "What's the matter?" I said.
"Look,"
he said, pointing to the sky. I saw nothing but a flock of wood pigeons swirling high above, some ways beyond where we were.
"The pigeons?" I said.
"They're agitated by something."
"What?"
"We'd best find out," he said. "Stay close."
Straight away, he loped off the road, and I followed. He led me into a small spinney, ample enough to hide us from view. Once there, he spied out. Without speaking, he pointed towards a hill some ways across the nearest field. When I nodded my understanding, he ran toward it. I kept close. Upon reaching the base of the hill, he dropped upon his hands and knees. Motioning that I should leave the sack behind, he began to crawl toward the hill crest. When he reached it, he pulled off his cap, then lifted his head just above the summit. After gazing a while, he turned slightly, beckoned me closer, and whispered,
"Look, but be careful not to show yourself."
Cautiously, I raised my head.